window with great howling whoops of happy abandon. They soon finished with the clothing on the couches and the luggage on the floor, and they were ransacking a cedar closet when the door to the inner room opened again, and a man who was very distinguished-looking from the neck up padded into view imperiously on bare feet.
"Here, you! Stop that!" he barked. "Just what do you men think you're doing?"
"Your toes are dirty," Dunbar said to him. The man covered his groin as the first had done and disappeared. Nately charged after him, but was blocked by the first officer, who plodded back in holding a pillow in front of him like a bubble dancer.
"Hey, you men!" he roared angrily. "Stop it!"
"Stop it!" Dunbar replied.
"That's what I said!"
"That's what I said!" Dunbar said. The officer stamped his foot petulantly, turning weak with frustration.
"Are you deliberately repeating everything I say? Are you deliberately repeating everything I say?" "I'll thrash you!" The man raised his fist.
"I'll thrash you," Dunbar warned him coldly. "You're a German spy, and I'm going to have you shot."
"German spy? I'm an American colonel!"
"You don't look like an American colonel. You look like a fat man with a pillow in front of him. Where's your uniform if you're an American colonel?"
"You just threw it out the window."
"All right, men," Dunbar said. "Lock the silly bastard up, take the silly bastard down to the station house, and throw away the key." The colonel blanched with alarm.
"Are you all crazy? Where's your badge? Hey, you, come back in here!"
But he whirled too late to stop Nately, who had glimpsed his girl sitting on the sofa in the other room and had darted through the doorway behind his back. The others poured through after him right into the midst of the other naked big shots. Hungry Joe laughed hysterically when he saw them, pointing in disbelief at one after the other and clasping his head and sides. Two, with fleshy physiques, advanced truculently until they spied the look of mean dislike and hostility on Dobbs and Dunbar, and noticed that Dobbs was still swinging like a two-handed club the wrought-iron ashstand he had used to smash things in the sitting room. Nately was already at his girl's side. She stared at him without recognition for a few seconds. Then she smiled faintly and let her head sink to his shoulder with her eyes closed. Nately was in ecstasy. She had never smiled at him before.
"Filippo,"
said a calm, slender, jaded-looking man who had not even stirred from his armchair,
"you don't obey orders. I told you to get him out, and you've gone and brought him in. Can't you see the difference?"
"They've thrown our things out the window, General."
"Good for them. And our uniforms, too? That was clever. We'll never be able to convince anyone we're superior without our uniforms."
"Let's get their names, Lou, and—"
"Oh, Ned, relax,"
said the slender man with practiced weariness.
"You may be pretty good at moving armored divisions into action, but you're almost useless in a social situation. Sooner or later we'll get our uniforms back, and then we'll be their superiors again." "Did they really throw our uniforms out? That was a splendid tactic."
"They threw everything out."
"The ones in the closet, too?"
"They threw the closet out, General. That was the crash we heard when we thought they were coming in to kill us."
"And I'll throw you out next,"
Dunbar threatened. The General paled slightly.
"What the devil is he so mad about?"
he asked Yossarian.
"He means it, too," Yossarian said. "You better let the girl leave."
"Lord, take her," exclaimed the General with relief. "All she's done is make us feel insecure. At least she might have disliked or resented us for the $100 we paid her. But she wouldn't even do that. Your handsome young friend there seems quite attached to her. Notice the way he lets his fingers linger on the inside of her thighs as he pretends to roll up her stockings."
Nately, caught in the act, blushed guiltily and moved more quickly through the steps of dressing her. She was sound asleep, and breathed so regularly that she seemed to be snoring softly.
"Let's charge her now, Lou," urged another officer. "We got more personnel, and we can encircle—"
"Oh, no, Bill," answered the General with a sigh. "You may be a wizard at directing a pincer movement in good weather on level terrain against an enemy that has already committed his reserves, but you don't always think so clearly anywhere else. Why should we want to keep her?
General, we're in a very bad strategic position. We haven't got a stitch of clothing, and it's going to be very degrading and embarrassing for the person who has to go downstairs through the lobby to get some.
Yes, Philpo, you're quite right, said the general. And that's exactly why you're the one to do it. Get going.
Naked, sir?
Take your pillow with you if you want to. And get some cigarettes, too, while you're downstairs picking up my underwear and pants, will you?
I'll send everything up for you,
Yossarian offered.
There, General, said Philpo with relief. Now I won't have to go.
Philpo, you nitwit. Can't you see he's lying?
Are you lying?
Yossarian nodded, and Philpo's faith was shattered. Yossarian laughed and helped Nately walk his girl out into the corridor and into the elevator. Her face was smiling as though with a lovely dream, as she slept with her head still resting on Nately's shoulder. Dobbs and Dunbar ran out into the street to stop a cab. Nately's whore looked up when they left the car. She swallowed dryly several times during the arduous trek up the stairs to her apartment, but she was sleeping soundly again by the time Nately undressed her and put her to bed. She slept for 18 hours, while Nately dashed about the apartment all the next morning, shushing everybody in sight. And when she woke up, she was deeply in love with him. In the last analysis, that was all it took to win her heart, a good night's sleep. The girl smiled with contentment when she opened her eyes and saw him, and then, stretching her long legs languorously beneath the rustling sheets, beckoned him into the bed beside her with that look of simpering idiocy of a woman in heat. Nately moved to her in a happy daze, so overcome with rapture that he hardly minded when her kid sister interrupted him again by flying into the room and flinging herself down onto the bed between them. Nately's whore slapped and cursed her, but this time with laughter and generous affection, and Nately settled back smugly with an arm about each, feeling strong and protective. They made a wonderful family group, he decided. The little girl would go to college when she was old enough, to Smith or Radcliffe or Bryn Mawr. He would see to that. Nately bounded out of bed after a few minutes to announce his good fortune to his friends at the top of his voice. He called to them jubilantly to come to the room and slammed the door in their startled faces as soon as they arrived. He had remembered just in time that his girl had no clothes on.
"Get dressed,"
he ordered her, congratulating himself on his alertness.
"Pourquoi?"
she asked curiously. "Pourquoi?" he repeated with an indulgent chuckle.
"Because I don't want them to see you without any clothes on."
"Pourquoi no?"
she inquired.
"Pourquoi no?"
he looked at her with astonishment.
"Because it isn't right for other men to see you naked, that's why."
"Pourquoi no?"
"Because I say so!"
Nately exploded in frustration.
"Now don't argue with me. I'm the man, and you have to do whatever I say. From now on, I forbid you ever to go out of this room unless you have all your clothes on. Is that clear?"
Nately's whore looked at him as though he were insane.
"Are you crazy? Che succede?"
"I mean every word I say."
"Tu sei pazzo!"
she shouted at him with incredulous indignation and sprang out of bed. Snarling unintelligibly, she snapped on panties and strode toward the door. Nately drew himself up with full manly authority.
"I forbid you to leave this room that way," he informed her.
"Tu sei pazzo!"
she shot back at him after she had left, shaking her head in disbelief.
"Idiota! Tu sei un pazzo imbecile!" "Tu sei pazzo!"
said her thin kid sister, starting out after her in the same haughty walk.
"You come back here!"
Nately ordered her.
"I forbid you to go out that way, too!"
"Idiota!"
the kid sister called back at him with dignity after she had flounced past.
"Tu sei un pazzo imbecile!"
Nately fumed in circles of distracted helplessness for several seconds, and then sprinted out into the sitting room to forbid his friends to look at his girlfriend while she complained about him in only her panties.
"Why not?"
asked Dunbar.
"Why not?" exclaimed Nately. "Because she's my girl now, and it isn't right for you to see her unless she's fully dressed."
"Why not?"
asked Dunbar.
"You see,"
said his girl with a shrug.
"Lui è pazzo." "Sì, è molto pazzo,"
echoed her kid sister.
"Make her keep her clothes on if you don't want us to see her," argued Hungry Joe. "What the hell do you want from us?"
"She won't listen to me," Nately confessed sheepishly. "So from now on, you all have to shut your eyes or look in the other direction when she comes in that way, okay?"
"Madonna,"
cried his girl in exasperation and stamped out of the room.
"Madonna,"
cried her kid sister and stamped out behind her.
"Lui è pazzo," Yossarian observed good-naturedly. "I certainly have to admit it."
"Hey, are you crazy or something?"
Hungry Joe demanded of Nately.
"The next thing you know, you'll be trying to make her give up hustling."
"From now on," Nately said to his girl, "I forbid you to go out hustling."
"Perché?"
she inquired curiously.
"Perché?" he screamed with amazement. "Because it's not nice, that's why."
"Perché no?"
"Because it just isn't," Nately insisted. "It just isn't right for a nice girl like you to go looking for other men to sleep with. I'll give you all the money you need so you won't have to do it anymore."
"And what will I do all day instead?"
"Do?" said Nately. "You'll do what all your friends do."
"My friends go looking for men to sleep with."
"Then get new friends. I don't even want you to associate with girls like that anyway. Prostitution is bad. Everybody knows that, even him."
He turned with confidence to the experienced old man.
"Am I right?"
"You're wrong," answered the old man. "Prostitution, it gives her an opportunity to meet people. It provides fresh air and wholesome exercise. It keeps her out of trouble."
"From now on," Nately declared sternly to his girlfriend, "I forbid you to have anything to do with that wicked old man."
"Vaffanculo,"
his girl replied, rolling her harassed eyes up toward the ceiling.
"What does he want from me?"
she implored, shaking her fists.
"Lasciami,"
she told him in menacing entreaty.
"Stupido, if you think my friends are so bad, go tell your friends not to ficky-fick all the time with my friends."
"From now on," Nately told his friends, I think you fellas ought to stop running around with her friends and settle down."
"Madonna,"
cried his friends, rolling their harassed eyes up toward the ceiling. Nately had gone clear out of his mind. He wanted them all to fall in love right away and get married. Dunbar could marry Orr's whore, and Yossarian could fall in love with Nurse Duckett, or anyone else he liked. After the war, they could all work for Nately's father and bring up their children in the same suburb. Nately saw it all very clearly. Love had transmogrified him into a romantic idiot, and they drove him away back into the bedroom to wrangle with his girl over Captain Black. She agreed not to go to bed with Captain Black again or give him any more of Nately's money, but she would not budge an inch on her friendship with the ugly, ill-kempt, dissipated, filthy-minded old man who witnessed Nately's flowering love affair with insulting derision and would not admit that Congress was the greatest deliberative body in the whole world.
"From now on,"
Nately ordered his girl firmly,
"I absolutely forbid you even to speak to that disgusting old man."
"Again, the old man?"
cried the girl in wailing confusion.
"Perché no?"
He doesn't like the House of Representatives."
"Mamma mia, what's the matter with you?"
"E pazzo,"
observed her kid sister philosophically.
"That's what's the matter with him."
"Sì,"
the older girl agreed readily, tearing at her long brown hair with both hands.
"Lui è pazzo."
But she missed Nately when he was away and was furious with Yossarian when he punched Nately in the face with all his might and knocked him into the hospital with a broken nose. 34. Thanksgiving. It was actually all Sergeant Knight's fault that Yossarian busted Nately in the nose on Thanksgiving Day, after everyone in the squadron had given humble thanks to Milo for providing the fantastically opulent meal on which the officers and enlisted men had gorged themselves insatiably all afternoon, and for dispensing like inexhaustible largesse the unopened bottles of cheap whiskey he handed out unsparingly to every man who asked. Even before dark, young soldiers with pasty white faces were throwing up everywhere and passing out drunkenly on the ground. The air turned foul. Other men picked up steam as the hours passed, and the aimless, riotous celebration continued. It was a raw, violent, guzzling Saturnalia that spilled obstreperously through the woods to the officers' club and spread up into the hills toward the hospital and the anti-aircraft gun emplacements. There were fistfights in the squadron, and one stabbing. Corporal Kolodny shot himself through the leg in the intelligence tent while playing with a loaded gun, and had his gums and toes painted purple in the speeding ambulance as he lay on his back with the blood spurting from his wound. Men with cut fingers, bleeding heads, stomach cramps, and broken ankles came limping penitently up to the medical tent to have their gums and toes painted purple by Gus and Wes and be given a laxative to throw into the bushes. The joyous celebration lasted long into the night, and the stillness was fractured often by wild, exultant shouts and by the cries of people who were merry or sick. There was the recurring sound of retching and moaning, of laughter, greetings, threats and swearing, and of bottles shattering against rock. There were dirty songs in the distance. It was worse than New Year's Eve. Yossarian went to bed early for safety, and soon dreamed that he was fleeing almost headlong down an endless wooden staircase, making a loud staccato clatter with his heels. Then he woke up a little and realized someone was shooting at him with a machine gun. A tortured, terrified sob rose in his throat. His first thought was that Milo was attacking the squadron again, and he rolled off his cot to the floor and lay underneath in a trembling, praying ball, his heart thumping like a drop forge, his body bathed in a cold sweat. There was no noise of planes. A drunken, happy laugh sounded from afar.
"Happy New Year! Happy New Year!"
A triumphant, familiar voice shouted hilariously from high above between the short, sharp bursts of machine-gun fire, and Yossarian understood that some men had gone as a prank to one of the sandbagged machine-gun emplacements Milo had installed in the hills after his raid on the squadron, and staffed with his own men. Yossarian blazed with hatred and wrath when he saw he was the victim of an irresponsible joke that had destroyed his sleep and reduced him to a whimpering hulk. He wanted to kill. He wanted to murder. He was angrier than he had ever been before, angrier even than when he had slid his hands around McWatt's neck to strangle him. The gun opened fire again. Voices cried, "Happy New Year!" And gloating laughter rolled down from the hills through the darkness like a witch's glee. In moccasins and coveralls, Yossarian charged out of his tent for revenge with his .45, ramming a clip of cartridges up into the grip and slamming the bolt of the gun back to load it. He snapped off the safety catch and was ready to shoot. He heard Nately running after him to restrain him, calling his name. The machine gun opened fire once more from a black rise above the motor pool, and orange tracer bullets skimmed like low gliding dashes over the tops of the shadowy tents, almost clipping the peaks. Roars of rough laughter rang out again between the short bursts. Yossarian felt resentment boil like acid inside him. They were endangering his life, the bastards. With blind, ferocious rage and determination, he raced across the squadron, past the motor pool, running as fast as he could, and was already pounding up into the hills along the narrow, winding path, when Nately finally caught up, still calling, "Yo-yo! Yo-yo!" with pleading concern and imploring him to stop. He grabbed Yossarian's shoulders and tried to hold him back. Yossarian twisted free, turning. Nately reached for him again, and Yossarian drove his fist squarely into Nately's delicate young face as hard as he could, cursing him, then drew his arm back to hit him again, but Nately had dropped out of sight with a groan and lay curled up on the ground with his head buried in both hands and blood streaming between his fingers. Yossarian whirled and plunged ahead up the path without looking back. Soon he saw the machine gun. Two figures leaped up in silhouette when they heard him and fled into the night with taunting laughter before he could get there. It was too late. Their footsteps receded, leaving the circle of sandbags empty and silent in the crisp and windless moonlight. He looked about dejectedly. Jeering laughter came to him again from a distance. A twig snapped nearby. Yossarian dropped to his knees with a cold thrill of elation and aimed. He heard a stealthy rustle of leaves on the other side of the sandbags and fired two quick rounds. Someone fired back at him once, and he recognized the shot.
"Dunbar?"
he called.
"Yossarian?"
The two men left their hiding places and walked forward to meet in the clearing with weary disappointment, their guns down. They were both shivering slightly from the frosty air and wheezing from the labor of their uphill rush.
"The bastards," said Yossarian. "They got away." "They took 10 years off my life,"
Dunbar exclaimed.
"I thought that son of a bitch Milo was bombing us again. I've never been so scared. I wish I knew who the bastards were." "One was Sergeant Knight."
"Let's go kill him."
Dunbar's teeth were chattering.
"He had no right to scare us that way."
Yossarian no longer wanted to kill anyone.
"Let's help Nately first. I think I heard him at the bottom of the hill."
But there was no sign of Nately along the path, even though Yossarian located the right spot by the blood on the stones. Nately was not in his tent, either, and they did not catch up with him until the next morning when they checked into the hospital as patients, after learning he had checked in with a broken nose the night before. Nately beamed in frightened surprise as they padded into the ward in their slippers and robes behind Nurse Kramer and were assigned to their beds. Nately's nose was in a bulky cast, and he had two black eyes. He kept blushing giddily in shy embarrassment and saying he was sorry when Yossarian came over to apologize for hitting him. Yossarian felt terrible. He could hardly bear to look at Nately's battered countenance, even though the sight was so comical he was tempted to guffaw. Dunbar was disgusted by their sentimentality, and all three were relieved when Hungry Joe came barging in unexpectedly with his intricate black camera and trumped-up symptoms of appendicitis to be near enough to Yossarian to take pictures of him feeling up Nurse Duckett. Like Yossarian, he was soon disappointed. Nurse Duckett had decided to marry a doctor. Any doctor, because they all did so well in business and would not take chances in the vicinity of the man who might someday be her husband. Hungry Joe was irate and inconsolable until, of all people, the chaplain was led in wearing a maroon corduroy bathrobe, shining like a skinny lighthouse with a radiant grin of self-satisfaction too tremendous to be concealed. The chaplain had entered the hospital with a pain in his heart that the doctors thought was gas in his stomach and with an advanced case of Wisconsin shingles.
"What in the world are Wisconsin shingles?" asked Yossarian.
"That's just what the doctors wanted to know,"
blurted out the chaplain proudly and burst into laughter. No one had ever seen him so waggish or so happy.
"There's no such thing as Wisconsin shingles, don't you understand? I lied. I made a deal with the doctors. I promised that I would let them know when my Wisconsin shingles went away if they would promise not to do anything to cure them. I never told a lie before. Isn't it wonderful?"
The chaplain had sinned, and it was good. Common sense told him that telling lies and defecting from duty were sins. On the other hand, everyone knew that sin was evil and that no good could come from evil. But he did feel good. He felt positively marvelous. Consequently, it followed logically that telling lies and defecting from duty could not be sins. The chaplain had mastered, in a moment of divine intuition, the handy technique of protective rationalization. And he was exhilarated by his discovery. It was miraculous. It was almost no trick at all, he saw, to turn vice into virtue and slander into truth, impotence into abstinence, arrogance into humility, plunder into philanthropy, thievery into honor, blasphemy into wisdom, brutality into patriotism, and sadism into justice. Anybody could do it. It required no brains at all. It merely required no character. With effervescent agility, the chaplain ran through the whole gamut of orthodox immoralities, while Nately sat up in bed with flushed elation, astounded by the mad gang of companions of which he found himself the nucleus. He was flattered and apprehensive, certain that some severe official would soon appear and throw the whole lot of them out like a pack of bums. No one bothered them. In the evening, they all trooped exuberantly out to see a lousy Hollywood extravaganza in Technicolor, and when they trooped exuberantly back in after the lousy Hollywood extravaganza, the soldier in white was there, and Dunbar screamed and went to pieces.
"He's back!" Dunbar screamed. "He's back! He's back!"
Yossarian froze in his tracks, paralyzed as much by the eerie shrillness in Dunbar's voice as by the familiar white, morbid sight of the soldier in white, covered from head to toe in plaster and gauze. A strange, quavering, involuntary noise came bubbling from Yossarian's throat.
"He's back!"
Dunbar screamed again.
"He's back!"
A patient delirious with fever echoed in automatic terror. All at once, the ward erupted into bedlam. Mobs of sick and injured men began ranting incoherently and running and jumping in the aisle as though the building were on fire. A patient with one foot and one crutch was hopping back and forth swiftly in panic, crying,
"What is it? What is it? Are we burning? Are we burning? He's back!"
Someone shouted at him.
"Didn't you hear him? He's back! He's back!"
"Who's back?" shouted someone else. "Who is it? What does it mean? What should we do?
Are we on fire?
Get up and run! Damn it, everybody get up and run!"
Everybody got out of bed and began running from one end of the ward to the other. One CID man was looking for a gun to shoot one of the other CID men who had jabbed his elbow into his eye. The ward had turned into chaos. The patient, delirious with a high fever, leaped into the aisle and almost knocked over the patient with one foot, who accidentally brought the black rubber tip of his crutch down on the other's bare foot, crushing some toes. The delirious man with the fever and the crushed toes sank to the floor and wept in pain, while other men tripped over him and hurt him more in their blind, milling, agonized stampede.
"He's back!"
all the men kept mumbling and chanting and calling out hysterically as they rushed back and forth.
"He's back! He's back!"
Nurse Kramer was there in the middle, suddenly like a spinning policeman, trying desperately to restore order, dissolving helplessly into tears when she failed.
"Be still! Please, be still!"
she urged uselessly through her massive sobs. The chaplain, pale as a ghost, had no idea what was going on. Neither did Nately, who kept close to Yossarian's side, clinging to his elbow, or Hungry Joe, who followed dubiously with his scrawny fists clenched and glanced from side to side with a face that was scared.
"Hey, what's going on?"
Hungry Joe pleaded.
"What the hell is going on?" "It's the same one!"
Dunbar shouted at him emphatically in a voice rising clearly above the raucous commotion.
"Don't you understand? It's the same one!"
"The same one!"
Yossarian heard himself echo, quivering with a deep and ominous excitement that he could not control, and shoved his way after Dunbar toward the bed of the soldier in white.
"Take it easy, fellas,"
the short patriotic Texan counseled affably with an uncertain grin.
"There's no cause to be upset. Why don't we all just take it easy?"
"The same one,"
others began murmuring, chanting and shouting. Suddenly, Nurse Duckett was there, too.
"What's going on?" she demanded.
"He's back," Nurse Kramer screamed, sinking into her arms. "He's back! He's back!"
It was, indeed, the same man. He had lost a few inches and added some weight, but Yossarian remembered him instantly by the two stiff arms and the two stiff, thick, useless legs, all drawn upward into the air almost perpendicularly by the taut ropes and long lead weights suspended from pulleys over him, and by the frayed black hole in the bandages over his mouth. He had, in fact, hardly changed at all. There was the same zinc pipe rising from the hard stone mass over his groin and leading to the clear glass jar on the floor. There was the same clear glass jar on a pole dripping fluid into him through the crook of his elbow. Yossarian would recognize him anywhere. He wondered who he was.
"There's no one inside!"
Dunbar yelled out at him unexpectedly. Yossarian felt his heart skip a beat and his legs grow weak.
"What are you talking about?"
he shouted with dread, stunned by the haggard, sparking anguish in Dunbar's eyes and by his crazed look of wild shock and horror.
"Are you nuts or something? What the hell do you mean there's no one inside?" "They've stolen him away!"
Dunbar shouted back.
"He's hollow inside, like a chocolate soldier! They just took him away and left those bandages there!"
"Why should they do that?"
"Why do they do anything?"
"They've stolen him away!"
screamed someone else, and people all over the ward began screaming,
"They've stolen him away! They've stolen him away!"
"Go back to your beds," Nurse Duckett pleaded with Dunbar and Yossarian, pushing feebly against Yossarian's chest. "Please, go back to your beds."
"You're crazy!"
Yossarian shouted angrily at Dunbar.
"What the hell makes you say that?"
"Did anyone see him?" Dunbar demanded with sneering fervor.
"You saw him, didn't you?"
Yossarian said to Nurse Duckett.
"Tell Dunbar, there's someone inside."
"Lieutenant Schmelker is inside," Nurse Duckett said. "He's burned all over."
"Did she see him?"
"You saw him, didn't you?"
"The doctor who bandaged him saw him."
"Go get him, will you? Which doctor was it?"
Nurse Duckett reacted to the question with a startled gasp. "The doctor isn't even here," she exclaimed. "The patient was brought to us that way from a field hospital."
"You see?"
cried Nurse Kramer.
"There's no one inside!"
"There's no one inside!"
yelled Hungry Joe and began stamping on the floor. Dunbar broke through and leaped up furiously on the soldier in white's bed to see for himself, pressing his gleaming eye down hungrily against the tattered black hole in the shell of white bandages. He was still bent over, staring with one eye into the lightless, unstirring void of the soldier in white's mouth when the doctors and the MPs came running to help Yossarian pull him away. The doctors wore guns at the waist. The guards carried carbines and rifles, with which they shoved and jolted the crowd of muttering patients back. A stretcher on wheels was there, and the soldier in white was lifted out of bed skillfully and rolled out of sight in a matter of seconds. The doctors and MPs moved through the ward, assuring everyone that everything was all right. Nurse Duckett plucked Yossarian's arm and whispered to him furtively to meet her in the broom closet outside in the corridor. Yossarian rejoiced when he heard her. He thought Nurse Duckett finally wanted to get laid and pulled her skirt up the second they were alone in the broom closet, but she pushed him away. She had urgent news about Dunbar.
"They're going to disappear him," she said.
Yossarian squinted at her uncomprehendingly.
"They're what?"
he asked in surprise and laughed uneasily.
"What does that mean?"
"I don't know. I heard them talking behind the door."
"Who?"
"I don't know. I couldn't see them. I just heard them say they were going to disappear Dunbar."
"Why are they going to disappear him?"
"I don't know."
"It doesn't make sense. It isn't even good grammar. What the hell does it mean when they disappear somebody?"
"I don't know."
"Jesus, you're a great help."
"Why are you picking on me?"
Nurse Duckett protested with hurt feelings and began sniffing back tears.
"I'm only trying to help. It isn't my fault they're going to disappear him, is it? I shouldn't even be telling you."
Yossarian took her in his arms and hugged her with gentle, contrite affection.
"I'm sorry,"
he apologized, kissing her cheek respectfully, and hurried away to warn Dunbar, who was nowhere to be found. 35. Milo the Militant. For the first time in his life, Yossarian prayed. He got down on his knees and prayed to Nately not to volunteer to fly more than 70 missions after Chief White Half-Oat did die of pneumonia in the hospital and Nately had applied for his job. But Nately just wouldn't listen.
"I gotta fly more missions,"
Nately insisted lamely with a crooked smile.
"Otherwise, they'll send me home."
"So?"
"I don't want to go home until I can take her back with me."
She means that much to you?
Nately nodded dejectedly. I might never see her again.
Then get yourself grounded, Yossarian urged. You've finished your missions, and you don't need the flight pay. Why don't you ask for Chief White Hapoot's job, if you can stand working for Captain Black?
Nately shook his head, his cheeks darkening with shy and regretful mortification.
They won't give it to me. I spoke to Colonel Korn, and he told me I'd have to fly more missions or be sent home.
Yossarian cursed savagely.
That's just plain meanness.
I don't mind, I guess. I've flown 70 missions without getting hurt. I guess I can fly a few more.
Don't do anything at all about it until I talk to someone,
Yossarian decided, and went looking for help from Milo, who went immediately afterward to Colonel Cathcart for help in having himself assigned to more combat missions. Milo had been earning many distinctions for himself. He had flown fearlessly into danger and criticism by selling petroleum and ball bearings to Germany at good prices in order to make a good profit and help maintain a balance of power between the contending forces. His nerve under fire was graceful and infinite. With a devotion to purpose above and beyond the line of duty, he had then raised the price of food in his mess hall so high that all officers and enlisted men had to turn over all their pay to him in order to eat. Their alternative, there was an alternative, of course, since Milo detested coercion and was a vocal champion of freedom of choice, was to starve. When he encountered a wave of enemy resistance to this attack, he stuck to his position without regard for his safety or reputation and gallantly invoked the law of supply and demand. And when someone somewhere said no, Milo gave ground grudgingly, valiantly defending, even in retreat, the historic right of free men to pay as much as they had to for the things they needed in order to survive. Milo had been caught red-handed in the act of plundering his countrymen, and as a result, his stock had never been higher. He proved good as his word when a raw-boned major from Minnesota curled his lip in rebellious disavowal and demanded his share of the syndicate Milo kept saying everybody owned. Milo met the challenge by writing the words, "A share," on the nearest scrap of paper and handing it away with a virtuous disdain that won the envy and admiration of almost everyone who knew him. His glory was at a peak, and Colonel Cathcart, who knew and admired his war record, was astonished by the deferential humility with which Milo presented himself at group headquarters and made his fantastic appeal for more hazardous assignment.
"You want to fly more combat missions?" Colonel Cathcart gasped. "What in the world for?"
Milo answered in a demure voice with his face lowered meekly.
"I want to do my duty, sir. The country is at war, and I want to fight to defend it like the rest of the fellows."
"But Milo, you are doing your duty,"
Colonel Cathcart exclaimed with a laugh that thundered jovially.
"I can't think of a single person who's done more for the men than you have. Who gave them chocolate-covered cotton?"
Milo shook his head slowly and sadly.
"But being a good mess officer in wartime just isn't enough, Colonel Cathcart."
"Certainly it is, Milo. I don't know what's come over you."
"Certainly it isn't, Colonel,"
Milo disagreed in a somewhat firm tone, raising his subservient eyes significantly just far enough to arrest Colonel Cathcart's.
"Some of the men are beginning to talk."
"Oh, is that it? Give me their names, Milo. Give me their names, and I'll see to it that they go on every dangerous mission the group flies."
"No, Colonel. I'm afraid they're right,"
Milo said, with his head drooping again.
"I was sent overseas as a pilot, and I should be flying more combat missions and spending less time on my duties as a mess officer."
Colonel Cathcart was surprised, but cooperative.
"Well, Milo, if you really feel that way, I'm sure we can make whatever arrangements you want. How long have you been overseas now?"
11 months, sir."
"And how many missions have you flown?"
5.
"Five?"
asked Colonel Cathcart.
5, sir."
"Five, eh?"
Colonel Cathcart rubbed his cheek pensively.
"That isn't very good, is it?"
"Isn't it?"
asked Milo in a sharply edged voice, glancing up again. Colonel Cathcart quailed.
"On the contrary, that's very good, Milo," he corrected himself hastily. "It isn't bad at all."
"No, Colonel," Milo said with a long, languishing, wistful sigh. "It isn't very good, although it's very generous of you to say so."
"But it's really not bad, Milo. Not bad at all when you consider all your other valuable contributions." 5 missions, you say? Just 5?
Just 5, sir.
Just 5.
Colonel Cathcart grew awfully depressed for a moment as he wondered what Milo was really thinking and whether he had already got a black eye with him.
5 is very good, Milo,
he observed with enthusiasm, spying a ray of hope.
That averages out to almost 1 combat mission every 2 months. And I'll bet your total doesn't even include the time you bombed us.
Yes, sir, it does.
It does?
Inquired Colonel Cathcart with mild wonder.
You didn't actually fly along on that mission, did you? If I remember correctly, you were in the control tower with me, weren't you?
But it was my mission, Milo contended. I organized it, and we used my planes and supplies. I planned and supervised the whole thing.
Oh, certainly, Milo, certainly. I'm not disputing you. I'm only checking the figures to make sure you're claiming all you're entitled to. Did you also include the time we contracted with you to bomb the bridge at Orvieto?
Oh, no, sir. I didn't think I should, since I was in Orvieto at the time, directing the anti-aircraft fire.
Well, I don't see what difference that makes, Milo. It was still your mission, and a damn good one, too, I must say. We didn't get the bridge, but we did have a beautiful bomb pattern. I remember General Peckham commenting on it. No, Milo, I insist you count Orvieto as a mission, too.
If you insist, sir.
I do insist, Milo. Now, let's see. You now have a grand total of 6 missions, which is damn good, Milo. Damn good, really. 6 missions is an increase of 20% in just a couple of minutes, which is not bad at all, Milo. Not bad at all.
Many of the other men have 70 missions, Milo pointed out.
But they never produced any chocolate-covered cotton, did they? Milo, you're doing more than your share.
But they're getting all the fame and opportunity, Milo persisted with a petulance that bordered on sniveling. Sir, I want to get in there and fight like the rest of the fellows. That's what I'm here for. I want to win medals, too.
Yes, Milo, of course. We all want to spend more time in combat. But people like you and me serve in different ways. Look at my own record.
Colonel Cathcart uttered a deprecatory laugh.
I bet it's not generally known, Milo, that I myself have flown only 4 missions, is it?
No, sir, Milo replied. It's generally known that you've flown only 2 missions, and that one of those occurred when Arfi accidentally flew you over enemy territory while navigating you to Naples for a black market water cooler. Colonel Cathcart, flushing with embarrassment, abandoned all further argument.
All right, Milo. I can't praise you enough for what you want to do. If it really means so much to you, I'll have Major Major assign you to the next 64 missions so that you can have 72.
Thank you, Colonel. Thank you, sir. You don't know what this means.
Don't mention it, Milo. I know exactly what it means.
No, Colonel, I don't think you do know what it means, Milo disagreed pointedly. Someone will have to begin running the syndicate for me right away. It's very complicated, and I might get shot down at any time. Colonel Cathcart brightened instantly at the thought and began rubbing his hands with avaricious zest.
You know, Milo, I think Colonel Korn and I might be willing to take the syndicate off your hands, he suggested in an offhand manner, almost licking his lips in savory anticipation. Our experience in black market plum tomatoes should come in very useful. Where do we begin?
Milo watched Colonel Cathcart steadily with a bland and guileless expression.
Thank you, sir. That's very good of you. Begin with a salt-free diet for General Peckham and a fat-free diet for General Dreidel.
Let me get a pencil. What's next?
The cedars.
Cedars?
From Lebanon.
Lebanon?
We've got cedars from Lebanon due at the sawmill in Oslo to be turned into shingles for the builder in Cape Cod, COD. And then there's the peas.
peas?
That are on the high seas. We've got boatloads of peas that are on the high seas from Atlanta to Holland to pay for the tulips that were shipped to Geneva to pay for the cheeses that must go to Vienna, M.I.F.
M.I.F.?
Money in front. The Habsburgs are shaky.
Milo...
And don't forget the galvanized zinc in the warehouse at Flint. 4 carloads of galvanized zinc from Flint must be flown to the smelters in Damascus by noon of the 18th. Terms FOB, Calcutta 2%, 10 days EOM. 1 Messerschmitt full of hemp is due in Belgrade for a C-47.5 full of those semi-pitted dates we stuck them with from Khartoum. Use the money from the Portuguese anchovies we're selling back to Lisbon to pay for the Egyptian cotton we've got coming back to us from Mamaroneck, and to pick up as many oranges as you can in Spain. Always pay cash for naranjas.
Naranjas?
That's what they call oranges in Spain. And these are Spanish oranges. And, oh yes, don't forget Piltdown Man.
Piltdown Man?
Yes, Piltdown Man. The Smithsonian Institution is not in a position at this time to meet our price for a second Piltdown Man, but they are looking forward to the death of a wealthy and beloved donor. And,
Milo,
France wants all the parsley we can send them. And I think we might as well, because we'll need the francs for the lira, for the pfennigs, for the dates when they get back. I've also ordered a tremendous shipment of Peruvian balsa wood for distribution to each of the mess halls in the syndicate on a pro rata basis.
Balsa wood? What are the mess halls going to do with balsa wood?
Good balsa wood isn't so easy to come by these days, Colonel. I just didn't think it was a good idea to pass up the chance to buy it.
No, I suppose not,
Colonel Cathcart surmised vaguely with the look of somebody seasick.
And I assume the price was right.
The price, said Milo, was outrageous, positively exorbitant. But since we bought it from one of our own subsidiaries, we were happy to pay it.
Look after the hides.
The hives?
The hides.
The hides.
The hides in Buenos Aires. They have to be tanned.
Tanned?
In Newfoundland. And shipped to Helsinki NMIF before the spring thaw begins. Everything to Finland goes NMIF before the spring thaw begins.
No money in front?
Guessed Colonel Cathcart.
Good, Colonel. You have a gift, sir. And then there's the cork.
The cork?
That must go to New York. The shoes for Toulouse, the ham for Siam, the nails from Wales, and the tangerines for New Orleans.
Milo,
we have coals in Newcastle, sir.
Colonel Cathcart threw up his hands.
Milo, stop!
He cried, almost in tears.
It's no use. You're just like I am. Indispensable.
He pushed his pencil aside and rose to his feet in frantic exasperation.
Milo, you can't fly 64 more missions. You can't even fly 1 more mission. The whole system would fall apart if anything happened to you.
Milo nodded serenely with complacent gratification.
Sir, are you forbidding me to fly any more combat missions?
Milo, I forbid you to fly any more combat missions,
Colonel Cathcart declared in a tone of stern and inflexible authority.
But that's not fair, sir, said Milo. What about my record? The other men are getting all the fame and medals and publicity. Why should I be penalized just because I'm doing such a good job as mess officer?
No, Milo, it isn't fair. But I don't see anything we can do about it.
Maybe we can get someone else to fly my missions for me.
But maybe we can get someone else to fly your missions for you,
Colonel Cathcart suggested.
How about the striking coal miners in Pennsylvania and West Virginia?
Milo shook his head.
It would take too long to train them. But why not the men in the squadron, sir? After all, I'm doing all this for them. They ought to be willing to do something for me in return.
But why not the men in the squadron, Milo?
Colonel Cathcart exclaimed.
After all, you're doing all this for them. They ought to be willing to do something for you in return.
What's fair is fair.
What's fair is fair.
They could take turns, sir.
They might even take turns flying your missions for you, Milo.
Who gets the credit?
You get the credit, Milo. And if a man wins a medal flying one of your missions, you get the medal.
Who dies if he gets killed?
Why, he dies, of course. After all, Milo, it's fair is fair. There's just one thing.
You'll have to raise the number of missions.
I might have to raise the number of missions again, and I'm not sure the men will fly them. They're still pretty sore because I jumped them to 70. If I can get just one of the regular officers to fly more, the rest will probably follow.
Nately will fly more missions, sir,
Milo said.
I was told in strictest confidence just a little while ago that he'll do anything he has to in order to remain overseas with a girl he's fallen in love with.
But Nately will fly more, Colonel Cathcart declared, and he brought his hands together in a resounding clap of victory. Yes, Nately will fly more, and this time I'm really going to jump the missions, right up to 80, and really knock General Dreedle's eye out. And this is a good way to get that lousy rat Yossarian back into combat where he might get killed.
Yossarian?
A tremor of deep concern passed over Milo's simple homespun features, and he scratched the corner of his reddish-brown mustache thoughtfully.
Yeah, Yossarian. I hear he's going around saying that he's finished his missions and the war's over for him. Well, maybe he has finished his missions, but he hasn't finished your missions, has he? has he got a surprise coming to him?
Sir Yossarian is a friend of mine, Milo objected. I'd hate to be responsible for doing anything that would put him back in combat. I owe a lot to Yossarian. Isn't there any way we could make an exception of him?
Oh, no, Milo,
Colonel Cathcart clucked sententiously, shocked by the suggestion.
We must never play favorites. We must always treat every man alike.
I'd give everything I own to Yossarian,
Milo persevered gamely in Yossarian's behalf.
But since I don't own everything, I can't give everything to him, can I? So he'll just have to take his chances with the rest of the men, won't he?
What's fair is fair, Milo.
Yes, sir. What's fair is fair,
Milo agreed.
Yossarian is no better than the other men, and he has no right to expect any special privileges, has he?
No, Milo. What's fair is fair.
And there was no time for Yossarian to save himself from combat once Colonel Cathcart issued his announcement raising the missions to 80 late that same afternoon. No time to dissuade Nately from flying them or even to conspire again with Dobbs to murder Colonel Cathcart. For the alert sounded suddenly at dawn the next day, and the men were rushed into the trucks before a decent breakfast could be prepared, and they were driven at top speed to the briefing room and then out to the airfield, where the clitter-clattering fuel trucks were still pumping gasoline into the tanks of the planes, and the scampering crews of armorers were toiling as swiftly as they could at hoisting the 1,000-pound demolition bombs into the bomb bays. Everybody was running, and engines were turned on and warmed up as soon as the fuel trucks had finished. Intelligence had reported that a disabled Italian cruiser in dry dock at La Spezia would be towed by the Germans that same morning to a channel at the entrance of the harbor and scuttled there to deprive the Allied armies of deepwater port facilities when they captured the city. For once, a military intelligence report proved accurate. The long vessel was halfway across the harbor when they flew in from the west, and they broke it apart with direct hits from every flight that filled them all with waves of enormously satisfying group pride until they found themselves engulfed in great barrages of flak that rose from guns in every bend of the huge horseshoe of mountainous land below. Even Havermeyer resorted to the wildest evasive action he could command when he saw what a vast distance he had still to travel to escape. And Dobbs, at the pilot's controls in his formation, zigged when he should have zagged, skidded his plane into the plane alongside and chewed off its tail. His wing broke off at the base, and his plane dropped like a rock and was almost out of sight in an instant. There was no fire. No smoke, not the slightest untoward noise. The remaining wing revolved as ponderously as a grinding cement mixer, as the plane plummeted nose downward in a straight line at accelerating speed until it struck the water, which foamed open at the impact like a whitewater lily on the dark blue sea, and washed back in a geyser of apple-green bubbles when the plane sank. It was over in a matter of seconds. There were no parachutes, and Nately, in the other plane, was killed too. 36. The Cellar. Nately's death almost killed the chaplain. Chaplain Tapman was seated in his tent, laboring over his paperwork and his reading spectacles, when his phone rang and news of the mid-air collision was given to him from the field. His insides turned at once to dry clay. His hand was trembling as he put the phone down. His other hand began trembling. The disaster was too immense to contemplate. 12 men killed. How ghastly. How very, very awful. His feeling of terror grew. He prayed instinctively that Yossarian, Nately, Hungry Joe, and his other friends would not be listed among the victims, then berated himself repentantly, for to pray for their safety was to pray for the death of other young men he did not even know. It was too late to pray, if that was all he knew how to do. His heart was pounding with a noise that seemed to be coming from somewhere outside, and he knew that he would never sit in a dentist's chair again, never glance at a surgical tool, never witness an automobile accident or hear a voice shout at night without experiencing that same violent thumping in his chest and dreading that he was going to die. He would never watch another fist fight without fearing he was going to faint and crack his skull open on the pavement or suffer a fatal heart attack or cerebral hemorrhage. He wondered if he would ever see his wife again or his three small children. He wondered if he ever should see his wife again, now that Captain Black had planted in his mind such strong doubts about the fidelity and character of all women. There were so many other men, he felt, who could prove more satisfying to her sexually. When he thought of death now, he always thought of his wife. And when he thought of his wife, he always thought of losing her. In another minute, the chaplain felt strong enough to rise and walk with glum reluctance to the tent next door for Sergeant Whitcomb. They drove in Sergeant Whitcomb's jeep. The chaplain made fists of his hands to keep them from shaking as they lay in his lap. He ground his teeth together and tried not to hear as Sergeant Whitcomb chirruped exultantly over the tragic event. 12 men killed meant 12 more form letters of condolence that could be mailed in one bunch to the next of kin over Colonel Cathcart's signature, giving Sergeant Whitcomb hope of getting an article on Colonel Cathcart into the Saturday Evening Post in time for Easter. At the field, a heavy silence prevailed, overpowering motion like a ruthless, insensate spell holding in thrall the only beings who might break it. The chaplain was in awe. He had never beheld such a great, appalling stillness before. Almost 200 tired, gaunt, downcast men stood holding their parachute packs in a somber and unstirring crowd outside the briefing room, their faces staring blankly in different angles of stunned dejection. They seemed unwilling to go, unable to move. The chaplain was acutely conscious of the faint noise his footsteps made as he approached. His eyes searched hurriedly, frantically, through the immobile maze of limp figures. He spied Yossarian, finally, with a feeling of immense joy, and then his mouth gaped open slowly in unbearable horror as he noted Yossarian's vivid, beaten, grimy look of deep, drugged despair. He understood at once, recoiling in pain from the realization and shaking his head with a protesting and imploring grimace, that Nately was dead. The knowledge struck him with a numbing shock. A sob broke from him. The blood drained from his legs and he thought he was going to drop. Nately was dead. All hope that he was mistaken was washed away by the sound of Nately's name, emerging with recurring clarity now from the almost inaudible babble of murmuring voices that he was suddenly aware of for the first time. Nately was dead. The boy had been killed. A whimpering sound rose in the chaplain's throat, and his